From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Knowledge at Wharton on Business Radio. Here's your host, Dan Loney.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Knowledge at Wharton on Sirius XM 132, Business Radio powered by the Wharton School. Great to have you with us as we start out the new week. It is June the 17th. Great having you listening to us wherever you are around the United States or up into Canada. Coming up on today's show at the top, protesting continuing over the weekend in Hong Kong over the potential new rule involving extradition of suspects to mainland China. Over 2 million people protested this past weekend. For now, the idea has been indefinitely suspended, but it is not 100% out of the question. We'll discuss what's occurring there in just a second. Then in about 30 minutes, the farming sector here in the U.S. has been dealing with heavy rains and flooding over the last few months, and that has made it harder to stay on schedule for farmers with some of their crops. Corn and soybean could be the most heavily impacted. We'll explain why in about 30 minutes' time. Then in hour number two, the belief or lack thereof surrounding climate change may be enhanced in either direction because of how the questions or the data is phrased or presented. A new report from here at the University of Pennsylvania looks at that phrasing and presentation and why they are playing a role. And then in our final 30, corporate social responsibility is growing as an area of need for many firms right now here in the U.S. and around the globe. Yet still some companies aren't 100% on board with the idea. We'll discuss the impact of CSR and where it may be leading us in the future. That comes your way at 11:30 Eastern time. All of that over the next 2 hours. Your comments and questions are welcome throughout. The way for you to join in is either by phone at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at Biz Radio, B-I-Z Radio 132, or my Twitter account at Dan Loney, L-O-N-E-Y-21. First, though, here's what you need to know from today's business headlines. Auction house Sotheby's will be acquired and taken private in a deal worth $57 a share, around $3.7 billion. The acquiring company, Bidfair USA, is owned by media and telecom entrepreneur Patrick Drahi. Pfizer is set to buy Array Biopharma for $10.64 billion. Array has already been approved for drugs for skin cancer and has other cancer drugs in the pipeline. The deal is expected to be completed in the second half of 2019. Target had an outage over the weekend with its cash registers. The problems prevented customers from making purchases on Saturday and from making credit card purchases for part of Sunday. The systems are said to be back working fine at this point. Speaking at the Paris Air Show, Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg said it is going to take time to win back the confidence of its customers following the two crashes of its 737 MAX aircraft. He also said that the company did not communicate well enough with regulators or with customers about the issues surrounding the cockpit warning light system. Hong Kong is in the midst of some of its largest protests as an estimated 1 to 2 million people continue to march against a bill that would allow extraditions of suspects to mainland China for trials. Over the weekend, the bill was indefinitely suspended by the territory's chief executive, Carrie Lam. Protesters are now demanding a complete withdrawal of the measure, an impartial investigation into the use of force by police against activists last Wednesday, and removal of the classification of the demonstrations as an illegal riot, which could expose those arrested to longer jail terms. They're also calling for Ms. Lam's resignation after refusing to accept her apology, which came through a press release. Hong Kong is an important business center, and the protests have become damaging to Beijing, which is already facing an economic slowdown and the trade war with the United States. Since returning to Chinese control, the former British colony has had incidents that tested both the political and legal boundaries of its independent status. So where could this all lead? Joining us on the phone, Jacques DeLille, law professor and political science professor here at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also deputy director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China, and also he is director of the Center for East Asian Studies here at the University of Pennsylvania. And also with us on the phone, Richard Dasher, director of the U.S. Asia Technology Management Center at Stanford University. Jacques, Richard, thank you, gentlemen, for your time today.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So, Jacques, give us a sense of where we stand with this bill right now. The term indefinitely suspended has been used, but I don't think many of the protesters believe that it is totally 100% out of view.
I think that's right. And what we have had is this massive set of protests that you just alluded to, and it has led to this pulling off the table of the bill. But no, it's not going away. And indeed, certainly the chief executive and the government in Hong Kong have by no means said that they do not intend to proceed at some point, and the protesters are out in the street calling for that permanent withdrawal. The fact the government hasn't said it implies that it is still out there. And we've seen this several times before in the history of Hong Kong's post-1997 return to China era. And this is just one where we're seeing, again, another popular movement that pushes back quite strongly against what they see as erosions of Hong Kong's promised autonomy, the autonomy that had been promised under the 1984 agreement between Britain and China that returned Hong Kong to Chinese rule. Anything that is really seen as a threat to Hong Kong's way of life, including its rule of law.
How did this bill first come about, Jacques, and why?
Well, it's really just one of these measures that I think telegraphs the degree to which the Hong Kong government, either pushed by Beijing or its own initiative to please Beijing, is trying to deal with concerns from the mainland side. So the immediate trigger was the murder in Taiwan of one Hong Kong resident by another. This couple went off to Taiwan for a vacation. The man killed the woman. They were both quite young. And the man returned to Hong Kong. And the question was, would he be sent back to Taiwan for prosecution and possible sentencing? The problem is that Hong Kong and Taiwan do not have an extradition agreement, and Taiwan initially sought the extradition, sought to have him back, but there was no mechanism for doing that. So the local government in Hong Kong used this as essentially the occasion to push for a bill that would allow the Hong Kong government to send criminal suspects to places with which Hong Kong doesn't have these kinds of agreements. So ostensibly it was about Taiwan, but the understanding, quite rightly, was it was really about sending criminal suspects back to the mainland. And there is a legitimate problem of people who commit crimes in the mainland, be they small, sort of ordinary violent crimes, or be they big-time criminals in the financial sector, you know, trying to get money out and that sort of thing, who then flee to Hong Kong. The mainland has a legitimate interest in getting those people back, and it's sort of a problem that they can't, and it is sort of odd for a part of China, Hong Kong, not to have a way of returning those citizens. But, of course, the concern that it raises is that people whom the mainland targets in Hong Kong, including political dissidents, including possibly business people — we did have the kidnapping of the booksellers a couple of years ago for selling books the mainland didn't like — this looks like a real risk that Hong Kong's government will then become complicit in sending to China and into its often politicized criminal justice process,
yeah,
people whom the mainland wants, but who may not have done anything that we would ordinarily consider, or that people in Hong Kong would ordinarily consider, properly prosecutable, or at least properly subject to the kind of prosecution people would face in the mainland.
Richard, in your opinion, how significant could this type of a bill be if it were to move forward in terms of the what the expectation should be of the people in Hong Kong, but also of the business community as well?
Well, I think that the current bill has turned out to be a very important line drawn in the sand by the people of Hong Kong, who really do not want to see the loss of their independent judiciary. They don't want to see the kind of special status that they have disappear and just fade away into being another city in mainland China. I think that there is a concern not only for how it would directly affect them, and also a concern by the Hong Kong business community about just what this would do to their reputation. In terms of regional trade with China and also with Southeast Asia, Hong Kong is very much in competition with Singapore, and the Singaporeans have their independence, and Hong Kong definitely wants to continue to emphasize the safety that investors and business people have working there.
Jacques?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think the problems occur at a few levels. The most dramatic issue is if there are people who are business people in Hong Kong who might be targeted for this. So we've seen incidents where the mainland has taken action against foreign businessmen in China, foreign business people in China, for what it sees as corrupt behavior, or what some would see as essentially attempts to shake them down. So those stories are out there. They have varying degrees of plausibility. Some of them are quite plausible. And that obviously is a concern for the foreign business community operating in the mainland. And of course, anything that, brings Hong Kong into that sphere of that kind of behavior is deeply distressing. That's sort of the tip of the iceberg. As Richard implied, there are also bigger questions, which is that Hong Kong's competitive advantage in the world is that it is a clean rule of law governed system. It's transparent. The judiciary has not been politicized, and so you will, in a sense, get a fair shake. So that whole system could be put at risk by the sense that this is another chipping away at the kind of autonomy that Hong Kong has enjoyed, particularly the independence of its judicial system. And you would see the reputation of that system begin to crack if you see the mainland demanding extradition of people pursuant to this agreement, and then the judicial review, which the bill would provide for, winds up being not all that probing after a Hong Kong government that has shown itself quite compliant or quite interested in maintaining its reputation with Beijing, that it would be quite willing to extradite people. And if the courts aren't then putting in a check, you've got a significant problem. Final layer to that is the business community has already spoken out strongly against it. The American Chamber of Commerce at Hong Kong issued a statement expressing concern about this. Some of the people who are ordinarily very establishment, very pro-Beijing, and are part of the Hong Kong business community, Hong Kongers, have also expressed concern. And once those people's views start getting ignored, that's a bad sign. And there is, of course, finally, this concern that if these protests keep erupting and disrupting business, Hong Kong looks like a somewhat ungovernable place, and one wonders where it will lead, and that's obviously not something the business community likes either.
Yeah, Richard, that was going to be my next question. From your perspective, how much impact could there be outside of the borders of Hong Kong on the business community of really taking a second look at Hong Kong? Obviously, it is an incredibly robust business area, but when you have this type of tension going on, it does, I would think, make some businesses wonder.
You have to imagine that people are going to calculate risk whenever they're considering something, and this new bill would definitely increase risk. Jacques mentioned the kind of concern that political dissidents or other people would be rounded up by the central Chinese government through this new extradition process, and that's a possibility. Because there is a kind of tradition in China where, especially if the party wants to assert its control over some leader, they arrest them on some criminal charge and then suspend the sentence. This is done quite a bit with very severe sentences where people go around and basically they're completely under the thumb of the government once this happens. Now, I think that in regard to what happened the last time we had a major protest in Hong Kong, the so-called umbrella movement, where basically there were people camped out in central Hong Kong for almost 80 days, it really didn't have that much impact on business. But I think that this time the scale of the protests are even bigger, and I think we're in a very different mood now that Xi Jinping has really kind of consolidated his grip on power in the mainland. It looks very different than it did.
So, Jacques, can you link what is going on with Hong Kong and the government, to a degree, trying to appease China with this, bringing this bill forward in the first place, with what has been going on in China in general, not necessarily just with Xi Jinping and his power, but with some of the economic components and obviously the trade war, and it's becoming a harder and harder time for the Chinese economy right now?
I think that's right, and I think you're seeing some of the reaction to what's going on now reflecting the sort of economic jitters, as it were. So one of the things that Richard alluded to, the Occupy Central umbrella movement from a few years ago, and in some ways this looks very much like that, but it's different in a couple of respects. One is, by the end of that movement, it had become somewhat unpopular in Hong Kong. A lot of the citizens had turned against the disruption. And this time it does seem to be a broader segment of Hong Kong society, people who are not primarily younger people, people in the business community speaking out against it, people inside the Hong Kong government speaking out against it. And I think it reflects this real concern that things are kind of fragile. Also, Occupy Central was about the failure to move forward on democratization. That is an aspirational goal of making Hong Kong a certain way. This is about unraveling what Hong Kong already has. So I think it suggests this general fragility that goes with the whole economic situation. Add to that that, as Richard said, Xi Jinping has consolidated power. He's consolidated power, but he's also facing a fair amount of blowback, a fair amount of criticism. So he's, I think, feeling this acute pressure. I mean, who knows? We're not inside his head. But there is this sense that he doesn't want to look soft or to back down on this. And so maybe Hong Kong government got a little bit out over its skis in pushing this bill, but the mainland government, you know, had backed it and had supported it. Now they've tried to back away from it a little bit, but they don't want to back away too far, or it looks like they're being weak. They have less room to maneuver, partly because their own economy is slowing down, partly because of the U.S.-China trade war, and now the Hong Kong issue has become another friction point in U.S.-China relations. So we see a bill introduced in Congress that would revisit Hong Kong's special status under U.S. law, because that's premised on reflecting and reinforcing Hong Kong's special autonomy and special liberal rule of law governed arrangement. If we start to erode that, then that takes away one of the avenues for the robustness of the U.S.-China relationship, which is on the skids in so many ways. So I think all of this has increased the pressure on all sides.
Richard?
Agreed. I think that the possibility that the U.S. government would pull back from the U.S.-Hong Kong Policy Act, which is the existing legislation that Jacques referred to, is a real serious kind of threat. And at this point, you also run into the problem of whether this is the government in China, in mainland, is really trying to make this current movement to be the result of foreign influence and trying to co-opt it in regard to being something where the outsiders are already trying to push Hong Kong around. But in fact, the scale of the demonstrations really is kind of beyond anything except a general people movement. It's really hard to see where this is going to go, though, because the movement now wants the chief executive, Ms. Carrie Lam, to step down. And if she does, that would certainly compromise Beijing's kind of control over the region.
Jacques, what has been the relationship between the government of Hong Kong and China over issues like we're talking about here, really since the control went back to China a couple of decades ago?
We've mostly seen the local government in Hong Kong, so a little bit of framing here. Hong Kong has a structure where there is a legislature, a legislative council, which has 70 members. By virtue of a somewhat gerrymandered structure, that is, you get people representing not the electorate as a whole for a fair number of seats, but representing so-called functional constituencies. What that structure does is mean that pro-mainland types wind up with a majority in the legislature, even though they don't get a majority of the vote. So there are people who are genuinely popularly elected in Hong Kong. There have been some impediments to pro-democracy people getting elected. It's a whole other story. But basically, despite majority support often for Democratic Party candidates, the pro-Beijing people dominate the legislature. The chief executive, Carrie Lam, at the moment, it is a chief executive-dominated government. So you see all of that. And Beijing works very closely with the chief executive. The chief executive is essentially picked by Beijing. I mean, it's vetted by a selection committee of Hong Kong elites, but they're generally pro-Beijing elites. So they're pretty closely aligned. Now, there have been occasional moments of some daylight there, but the dynamic that has led to the kinds of big deal conflicts we've seen in Hong Kong, whether it be the Occupy Central movement over democratization, whether it be the Article 23 legislation about a decade and a half ago that would have outlawed sedition of various sorts, or whether it be something like patriotic education. We've seen this time and time again where the Hong Kong local government, either at the behest of Beijing or to some degree trying to please Beijing and getting out ahead of what Hong Kong public opinion will tolerate, winds up in these kinds of fixes. And so then you wind up seeing the crisis emerge, and then what does Beijing do? And right now we're seeing the kind of tension that we were talking about earlier and that Richard was mentioning. So on the one hand, you have Beijing having backed this bill and having supported the idea of the need to set up this in lieu of extradition or sort of arrangement to do extradition, that they backed the bill, but now in the last couple days after the bill was indefinitely tabled, they've stopped mentioning support for Carrie Lam specifically.
Yeah.
At the same time that they've complained that the U.S. and others are essentially the black hands behind this, they called in the U.S. Embassy senior official to complain about interference in Chinese affairs with the bill to amend the Hong Kong Policy Act. So we're seeing they're sort of pushing back in both directions, but I think they're really caught in a very tough situation. And if Carrie Lam goes, they have to pick a new chief executive, and this would be the fourth chief executive to have failed to follow the trajectory of an expected two terms, or even in this case, to fill out one term. And then they got to go back to the drawing board, and that creates another focus for a political crisis in Hong Kong. So I don't think they really have a good way out of this.
Should Ms. Lam go, though, in your opinion?
Well, I think she certainly lost the confidence of the Hong Kong people, and I think it's going to be hard to get it back. And I think chief executives who have been in less trouble than she has have been squeezed out. And I would think that there's a good chance she will go, given where Beijing is now, although they don't want to do it. I mean, I don't see how you claw your way back from this. She could, of course, stay on. There's no real process for removing her, but I think she's going to have real problems being effective.
Richard?
I agree. I think that in some ways her statements of apologies almost are in anticipation of being asked to step down. I think that what happens with this legislation is probably the bigger, thornier question. She could go easily, really. Depending on how this is managed, the central government will look worse or will not look worse. But with this legislation, if it is just left in kind of the table without clearly being shot down or put through, you have a kind of one more sort of stretching of the rubber band to see how much you can continue to have a system as usual versus really have the kind of very different system that's in China. I'm not sure that the two can really be reconciled over the long term.
You're listening to Knowledge at Wharton on Sirius XM 132, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Joined on the phone by Jacques DeLisle of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Richard Dasher of Stanford University. Your comments at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. I guess, Jacques, you had mentioned before about the one instance of the couple in Taiwan, but in terms of the relationship between the two sides here, was an extradition bill of some kind necessary?
That's the view within Hong Kong. I mean, so at the international law level, governments are free to extradite people to other governments on request. What an extradition treaty does is it creates a process for doing this, and it makes it more kind of law-governed and less ad hoc. But the view in Hong Kong was to do that kind of arrangement, to send somebody back without a formal extradition agreement, was problematic, so they're going to set up a bill to do it. There are genuine problems to be dealt with here, but I think one of the many ways that Carrie Lam played it badly, and it puts her in the precarious position that Richard was referring to, is that she used this Taiwanese incident as essentially the pretext for pushing through. She said, yeah, you know, the victim's family, they're so upset, they need justice, and the victim's family was genuinely upset. But the idea that this was really about Taiwan was just nonsensical. There's no real impediment to sending somebody back to Taiwan with its quite fair judicial system for criminal process. It was just a Hong Kong sticking point that they wouldn't do it without a formal agreement. But everybody knew the real issue here was the mainland, because we had had the kidnapping of the booksellers for prosecution in the mainland. There was this sense that mainland authority was reaching into Hong Kong to get people whom the mainland, rightly or wrongly, considered criminals, and this would then make it a much more regular and easier process. So to play that card of the family of the young Hong Kong woman who was killed in Taiwan was just, you know, transparent and clumsy on her part, especially once Taiwan said, we're not going to seek extradition if the way it comes about is through this bill that erodes Hong Kong's autonomy.
Does this, it would seem, Jacques, to put Hong Kong right now at an interesting kind of crossroads in its history, in the fact that with the numbers of people that you have protesting, you obviously have people believe that this is not right, and that they have developed, even still with a relationship with China, they have a quote-unquote freedom that they expect to be followed, you know, by the letter of the law. Yet you have a government that seemingly wants to build out that relationship with the Chinese government, or at least through Carrie Lam, you want to have that relationship built out even further.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, clearly there is a disagreement about how to interpret this one country, two systems type structure. And people in Hong Kong, at the very least, want to maintain the integrity and independence of their legal system, and they want to maintain a liberal set of civil liberties that they've enjoyed for quite some time. They also want progressive movement toward democratization, or at least many people in Hong Kong do, and that was promised in the Joint Declaration. So what you have is this gap where people in Hong Kong keep pushing for movement down that path, and this is indeed what Occupy Central was about a few years ago, movement down that path toward strong autonomy, democratic rule, civil liberties, and all of that. And the mainland, under Xi Jinping especially, and with the concerns that they have about what's going on in Hong Kong, and is that a contagion that will spread to the mainland, they're actually going in opposite directions. And this all gets more fraught as the guarantee of Hong Kong's autonomy and continuity with the pre-return system has a sell-by date on it. It's promised only for 50 years, which would be 2047. It may well go beyond that, but the promise even formally only extends to 2047. And then you get some concrete things. One of the objections to this bill, which says you can be extradited for 37 offenses, is some of those could be applied fairly broadly. And one of the things that really gave the willies to the business community was the possibility that this would lead to the authorization of seizing or freezing assets in Hong Kong for targeted business people.
Richard?
The foreign companies that are doing business in Hong Kong, especially those that are interested in the mainland China market, are already very careful in the way that they talk about China and in the way that they talk about the situation at the present time. It's been kind of exceptional over the last few months, the criticism against this extradition bill that has come from the community in Hong Kong, not only the American Chamber of Commerce, but the general Hong Kong Chamber of Commerce put out a statement against it back in March. So I think that you have real concern on the business community that in some ways is really more about reputation and about what might happen than it is about an immediate threat.
Great having you both with us. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your time. All the best. We will talk to you again in the very near future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Jacques DeLisle from here at the University of Pennsylvania and the Law School, Richard Dasher at Stanford University. We will take our first break of the show. When we come back, we're going to talk about the farming sector right now, which has had a rough start to 2019. Lots of heavy rains, lots of snow melt, lots of flooding, and it is impacting a variety of farmers across the United States. Now, projections by the USDA are looking at lower corn harvests, and you could also see an impact on soybean as well. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Sirius XM 132, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.